There's something new about tourism that goes beyond bucket lists. Paige McClanahan believes we're waking up to the power and perils that our travels can unleash.
Be aware of the impact that we're going to have on the place that we're visiting.
Coming up, we'll examine how our travels can be a force for good if we start with an open mind and the right attitude.
You are a member of a vast and potent social force.
Journalist Sophie Roberts has been learning about Belgium's King Leopold II's ambitious plan for plundering the resources of Africa. To do it, he shipped elephants from India to the Congo.
It's just a story of extraction and exploitation at a phenomenal level.
Sophie tells us how she uncovered this hidden history from the African's point of view by taking time to talk to people.
I could only find it by giving them hours under a starlit sky, and it was really beautiful. I loved that.
We'll hear what her travels revealed in the hour ahead. Come along. It's Travel with Rick Steves. We're meeting with two journalists today on Travel with Rick Steves who promised to help us see the world and our travels in a new light. Paige McClanahan has been looking into the contemporary forces that have redefined mass tourism of the 20th century into one of the world's major growth industries. She recommends new ways we can engage with the world one-on-one in just a moment. And later in the hour, Sophie Roberts retraces a curious but little-remembered episode from the colonial era when Leopold II, the King of Belgium, shipped elephants from India to help plunder the resources of the Congo. Sophie followed the route of four elephants to piece together their long-forgotten story. But it's one that the people she met knew all about. Lately, it feels like everyone's in a race all around the world to tick off places on their bucket lists and to take pictures in front of social media hotspot destinations. And overcrowded tourist spots and local backlash against invading hordes of tourists are making headlines. Tourism is a bigger and bigger industry. In fact, today it's one of the biggest employers on the planet. Tourism provides an estimated 10% of the global economy. In her book, The New Tourist, journalist Paige McClanahan argues for a new kind of traveler, someone who's more thoughtful about the place and the people, someone who's more open to learning and comes back with a different understanding of their own home. Paige writes about shedding the ways of the old tourist whose self-interests dominated their travels and stepping into the ways of a more thoughtful traveler. Paige, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
So your book is all about the new tourist. In fact, that's the name of it. Define the old tourist and the new tourist.
Yeah, well, as you said in the introduction there, I really see an old tourist as somebody who approaches their travels with a really consumerist perspective and who sees themselves as better than the people or places they're visiting, who comes, yeah, to tick a box, you know, to get something for their Instagram feed or that they can brag about to their friends back home. And who also remains closed to the experience, who doesn't open their hearts and minds to making real connections with the people and the places they're visiting, and who also kind of remains willfully blind to their impacts on the place. Because I think, you know, one thing that we can do that's so helpful is to really be aware of the impact that we're going to have on the place that we're visiting.
Wow, that's pretty fundamental. So I guess the takeaway is the attitude you bring with you shapes the experience.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is what I love so much about your work as well, Rick, is that I see you really encouraging people in this direction. And at the other end of the spectrum, you know, we have the new tourist who I see as somebody who really travels with an open heart, an open mind, a huge amount of humility and curiosity, and a real willingness to engage in the issues in the place and educate themselves about the challenges that the place they're visiting might be experiencing with regard to tourism. And then, you know, really implicating themselves and trying to be part of a better, you know, way forward for tourism instead of, you know, contributing to the destructive sides of the activity. Because we have to admit that tourism, when it's done in the wrong way, can be pretty destructive.
Do you get an A+ because you invented this concept and are you the perfect new tourist?
Absolutely not. And, you know, in the book, I like to take people along with me. I say, I, like everybody else, I'm doing my best, right? Have I made mistakes in the past? For sure. You know, do I always embody, you know, this ideal form of a tourist? Absolutely not. Do I always try my best? Am I always out there, you know, leaning into it and trying? Yes. That's really one of the messages I want to bring home is that the importance of really, you know, not searching for perfection, but doing your best no matter what the circumstances are.
That's funny because I've got a new photograph that I put in my talks and it's a giant wooden shoe. and there's a tourist sitting in the wooden shoe, you know, mugging for the camera. And I say, right there in downtown Amsterdam, right on Dam Rack between Hooters and the Hard Rock Cafe, there's a big wooden shoe. And if I see that, I'm going to get in it because I'm a tourist and I want to get a shot of me sitting in a big wooden shoe. It's okay. We're tourists, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, and when I talk about the old tourist and the new tourist, I think it's really important to say that, you know, we're traveling because we want to have fun and we want to learn and we want to have an adventure. And, you know, leaning into the sort of the heart opening and mind opening aspects of tourism, as you know very well, it doesn't mean that this has to become a homework assignment. This can really elevate our experience while we're traveling.
Now, this book you've written, The New Tourist by Paige McClanahan, it's a substantial book. And you interviewed so diligently hundreds of people. I was one of them. I remember how hard at work you were. You had this approach of listen and learn, and that sort of helped you build this critical mass to put this book together. I know that your interview with me was probably your favorite out of all the thousands, but apart from that, what's a particularly helpful conversation that comes to mind? What were some of the eurekas that you enjoyed with these interviews?
Oh, I really enjoyed speaking to you, Rick, as always. Such a delightful conversation. Actually, one conversation that I had really stuck in my mind, and I have returned to this, you know, over and over, and I describe it in the last chapter of the book, and it happened when I was in Saudi Arabia. And it was with a guy, it wasn't even an official interview, but I ended up having a conversation with this guy who, a Saudi man who ended up coming and jumping the car that my tour guide and I were trying to use to get to the airport. She was going to give me a lift to the airport. And ended up having this conversation with this young Saudi man, 23, 24 years old, very friendly, very helpful. And he was so eager to tell me about the trip that he had had to the United States a year or two before. And I had been so scared as a woman, as a journalist who didn't know much about the Middle East before I traveled there. I had been scared to go to Saudi Arabia. And here I meet this Saudi Arabian man who told me that he had been scared before his trip to the United States, but that he was so surprised. He went to New York City and he went to Orlando, and he was so surprised. He was like, Paige, do you know, when I was there, I felt so safe the entire time. He told me, the United States is nothing like what you see in the news or on social media. And I just got, you know, goosebumps all over my body. And I was like, absolutely, this is why we travel. And I, you know, met him in a parking lot, you know, one on a Friday evening in Riyadh. And we had this beautiful moment of exchange. And that's definitely one conversation that has really stuck with me.
You know, you talk about the sweep of the history of tourism in your book. And I was thinking wanderlust is a pretty basic emotion. It's a drive that many of us have. It's essentially curiosity, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think for me, it's a real desire to get out of my comfort zone. And I think, you know, as you write very well in your Hippie Trail book, you know, getting out of your comfort zone can mean having the runs and being uncomfortable, but it can also mean just having a conversation with somebody who's going to shift your perspective on something. And I think me, travel, wanderlust is all about searching for those areas of discomfort that will give us the opportunity to grow, which I think is a really, you know, an important human impulse.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're evolving our outlook on travel now with journalist Paige McClanahan. Paige contributes to the New York Times with a focus on tourism. She hosts a podcast called The Better Travel Podcast. And her just published book is The New Tourist, Waking Up to the Power and Perils of Travel. You can find more of her work at her website. It's PaigeMcClanahan.com. P-A-I-G-E, McClanahan.com. Paige, you had fun doing a look at the evolution of tourism and how it's been democratized in the last generation or so, and the advent of mass tourism. And you also talked about how travel information has evolved with it. Give us a sweep of how you see travel information as something that shapes how people travel and where it's going.
Well, I was really interested in the book to explore the rise of the modern travel guidebook, because this was a history that fascinated me that I hadn't seen anybody else approaching this topic with a level of detail that, you know, that interested me. So basically, in the first chapter, I start with the rise of the guidebook in the 1970s and 80s, because I see this as a real, a real important moment in modern social history. It's easy to forget just how little information there was for travelers. You write about this in your book as well, you know, going back to the 1970s. If you wanted to travel outside the well-beaten tourist trails in Europe or the United States, you really struggled to find information. In the 1970s and 80s, we saw a real growth in what we now know as, you know, the modern travel guidebook. Of course, guidebooks had existed before then, but not nearly in such a comprehensive way around the world. And then, you know, starting in the 1990s, we start to see the shift to digital, you know, digital travel bookings, digital travel information. And then with the rise of social media in the 2000s and 2010s, this is when we really start to see a big shift of travel information. Travel writing became a much more digital medium. And so I argue in the second chapter of the book that actually social media is, you know, the most influential form of travel writing in the modern day world. And so I take a close look at the pros and cons of that, because I think it's a really wonderful development in some ways. We've really exploded the number and diversity of voices of people who are contributing to the, you know, the travel writing world, who are able to recount their own travel narratives. At the same time, we do see negative impacts of social media in the world of travel, as I'm sure you've seen. You know, places can be overrun. So I think there's a really interesting sort of two sides to that coin.
Well, let's get into some specifics on that. In your chapter, Under the Influence, what is a positive impact of social media and a negative impact of social media when it comes to how we look at the world as tourists?
I might start with the negative here. I describe in that chapter how I went to Iceland and I visited what is commonly known now as the Justin Bieber Canyon, which is a small little canyon kind of off the side of a road in the middle of nowhere in the south of Iceland that became a huge sort of sensation in terms of tourist numbers after Justin Bieber showed up with a film crew and filmed a music video there. And after that, the number of crowds just really, really grew. And I spent some time with a park ranger who was there managing the site. And she explained to me how they had to shut down the site because the fragile grasses had been trampled and were not able to recover. And she really said to me, she said, you know, Paige, I see people coming. I see them taking a photo. I see them getting back in their car and driving off. And she sees this as a real problem of social media that's driving people to do this. She wants people to come and engage with the nature and learn about the nature and learn about the whole landscape, not just get the photo and leave. So from her perspective, social media was encouraging a more superficial kind of consumption, if you will, of this beautiful natural landscape.
Well, like it or not, that's a big part of travel these days is Game of Thrones was shot here, or Da Vinci Code had a scene here, or this is where I'm supposed to go for my Instagram selfie. And I've got this deep in my gut feeling about this is not anything I want to have anything to do with. I just think it's a fleeting, simple-minded approach to travel when you're right there and you could actually know about that culture and about the people and you could learn from it. So that's an interesting new dimension of travel, and I'm glad you deal with that in your book. Paige McClanahan has reported on economic trends and trade negotiations from more than a dozen countries for major outlets like The New York Times, The Guardian, and the BBC. She's joining us on Travel with Rick Steves from her home in Paris as we look at changing realities in global tourism. There's more with Paige in just a minute as we examine how our own travels can also be meaningful and welcomed by the people we visit. A few years ago on Travel with Rick Steves, she took us on an evocative journey looking for the lost pianos of Siberia. In a little bit, Sophie Roberts is back to tell us about an incredible story she's uncovered from the European colonial era in Africa, a little remembered piece of history that centers on a training school for elephants. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Paige McClanahan, and her book is The New Tourist, Waking Up to the Power and Perils of Travel. Paige, there are some examples these days of tourism that is just not good for local neighborhoods. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, what comes to mind for me is the impact of short-term rentals.
Yeah, that was one issue that I looked at specifically when I was in Barcelona for the book. I spent a lot of time with a wonderful urban planner and architect who took me around her home city of Barcelona and showed me in great detail just how tourism has changed the fabric of the neighborhoods where she grew up in Barcelona in the 1980s. And for her, short-term rentals are really a big part of the problem. So she's spending a lot of time mapping the effect of short-term rentals and looking at how this is influencing the shape and layout of the city. I remember standing in a square and she was showing me around and saying, look, here, you know, you can buy a poke bowl, you can get a latte, you can buy a tourist trinket. Where can you buy an apple? Where can you buy a loaf of bread? Where can you find a laundromat? You know, and she was describing just how much the city had come to serve visitors rather than residents. You know, it's really an active issue in Barcelona now and one that will be interesting to follow.
Whether it's short-term rentals or just people having a second home in a village because they like the view and they go there on Christmas, that means there's less children in that town. That means there's not a critical mass of people to have a doctor or a church or a school. And then that town becomes gutted. It has no more culture of its own. And it's just a place that accommodates wealthy, privileged people who have a cabin there or short-term rentals of people waltzing in and out with no interest in the local community. You mentioned over-tourism, and there's this bad press of too many tourists in Amsterdam, too many tourists in Hawaii, too many tourists in Barcelona, tourists go home, and people throwing things at tourists or whatever. I think that can be overstated. People need to understand what is good tourism and what is bad tourism. In Barcelona, all tourism is not bad tourism. There's certain kinds of tourism that contribute nothing but pollution and congestion to the society. That would be bad tourism, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think of the example of Venice, which I haven't actually visited Venice yet, but I'm looking forward to going. But I have an Italian friend who's a journalist, and I was talking to her about it, and she was really encouraging people to visit Venice. And she said, you know, go out of season, stay for several days. There are museums in Venice that suffer from low tourist numbers that are just a little bit off the beaten path. You know, there are a lot of businesses you can support. There is a way to visit, you know, an iconic tourist destination like Venice in a way that is going to contribute and that's going to be interesting for you and fun for you and where, you know, can have the opportunity to make a really positive contribution to the place itself. So I think the word over-tourism, I think, you know, it needs to be used really carefully because you can kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater sometimes. It's not always the most helpful term, although, of course, it's really important that we do come to terms with the fact that in some places, at some times, tourism can be overbearing on a place.
Well, over-tourism would be 3,000 people piling off of a cruise ship and inundating Dubrovnik all at the same time. Over-tourism might be a parking lot full of tour buses coming into Rotenburg in the middle of the day for a 3-hour look at the city. Over-tourism might be hen parties and stag parties that are filling the streets of Seville or Krakow or Prague with broken beer bottles and noise late at night. That's the kind of tourism that people don't like. I'm amazed or impressed or thankful that mayors and presidents of tourist boards invite me into their office when I'm in a touristy town like Rotenburg, and they give me a lunch and a plaque of thank you for good tourism. You know, a good tourist buys dinner, spends the night, consumes in a way where dollars stay in that community. And we're an important part of the economic fabric of that community. That's what employs people. That's what butters their bread. So there's good tourism and there's bad tourism. And that's going to even get more so as we go into the future. So we've got that. We've got the thought that a lot of the world, whether it's in Venice or just in Italy in general, has almost no tourism. And there's plenty of rewards there. And then what you brought out in your book, there's a sort of a Goldilocks just right in the middle where you've got plenty of razzle-dazzle and none of this congestion. Talk a little bit about the middle between too much and not enough tourism.
I like to say for every place that you see in the news, you know, a headline about too many tourists, over-tourism, there are at least half a dozen, if not more, places that are actively working to attract tourists that are still wanting tourists to come. But one place that I write about in the book that I found really fascinating that I didn't know before visiting and doing the research for my book is the city of Liverpool in England, which has a really fascinating story. In the 1970s and 80s, it was one of the poorest urban areas in Europe. It was known for its kind of riots and having a huge drug problem. And then starting in the late 1980s with the opening of the Tate Liverpool, this, you know, beautiful modern art museum right on the city's waterfront, the city really started to move into tourism and lean on tourism and use tourism as a way to transform its economy and to transform its image, especially on the international stage. And I visited tourism in the summer of 2023. It was just after the city had hosted the Eurovision Song Contest. And it was just such a vibrant place. And people were so open to visitors. I was standing on this sort of open plaza, just sort of admiring the buildings. And a man literally walked up to me and started explaining the meaning of the liverbirds that are sitting on top of one of the buildings. And he was just became an impromptu tour guide. And he was like a union leader in one of the shipyards. I mean, it was a wonderful experience. So Liverpool, I would certainly recommend as a place for people to consider.
Liverpool is an example of one of those cities I like to call second cities. You know, everybody goes to Bath. What about Bristol? Everybody goes to Lisbon. What about Porto? Everybody goes to Dublin. What about Belfast? Everybody goes to Berlin. What about Hamburg? These are cities that are very important. They're very edgy. They're very creative. They're not touristy. And you'll get a big warm welcome like you got in Liverpool. And you can do that as you shape your itinerary. Paige McClanahan is our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. She's making a case for a new kind of traveler, one who's more thoughtful and interested in learning from the world. Her book details what she's discovered in researching the subject of the new tourist. Paige also interviewed me for a story in the New York Times, and she hosts a podcast where she interviews a wide variety of thoughtful travelers. If you look into her third season interviews, you'll even find me, again, as her guest, talking about the art of Europe. It's at bettertravelpodcast.com. You also talk about the flattening of the world through tourism. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on how tourism contributes to this.
I think it's so easy for us to forget just how vast and potent a force tourism is. We went from, in 1950, we had 25 million international tourist arrivals, to last year it was 1.4 billion. You know, that's growth of more than 5,000% in, what, you know, 74 years. And over that space of that time, you know, tourism has touched just about every corner of this planet, right? You know, from the, you know, mountain peaks to the bottom of the ocean in some places.
Yeah.
And it has transformed economies. You know, in so many parts of the world, tourism is a huge part of the economy. It has created jobs. It has created really profound financial incentives to protect some of humanity's most important cultural heritage, right? Because if you can sell tickets to a place, then, you know, suddenly you have a real immediate incentive to protect it. The same goes for a lot of our natural landscapes. So in some ways, tourism has monetized some really important assets. In other ways, of course, it has overrun communities and it has run down some of our most important cultural and environmental sites. So tourism is a vast and potent social force. And my message to readers is really to keep that in mind when you're traveling. You know, remember that, yes, you're on vacation. Yes, you're there to have a good time. At the same time, you are a member of a vast and potent social force, whether you like it or not, whether you even realize it or not, you are. And let's keep that in mind and let's be the best tourists and travelers we can be.
Paige, when we talk about over-tourism and we talk about examples of bad tourism, there are ethical issues beyond the crowds. And you talk about this in your book. You know, there are shoppers buying ivory souvenirs in Africa. There are golf courses in parched lands taking up all the water. There's sex tourism in Southeast Asia. What are some examples of tourism that you think is unethical?
I think one aspect of tourism that we need to be really careful of and that might not seem unethical at first glance is what we call maybe poverty tourism or slum tourism, where you're visiting a country that's perhaps much poorer than your own. You can go on a tour in a lot of these places. And I know I've lived in Sierra Leone, one of the poorest countries in the world, and also in Kenya. And in these kinds of places, you can go on a tour of a slum or a poor village. And, you know, it's certainly possible to do these kinds of community tourism in a way that is supportive and constructive and ethical. But a lot of these tours are run in ways that are kind of treating the people in the village or in the neighborhood as kind of animals in a zoo. They might not be compensated for the fact that you're coming to look around their home. So I think, you know, we really need to be careful, especially when we're in a position of being much wealthier than the people we're visiting, to make sure that we're engaging in a community in a way that's on terms that are set by the people who live in that community and that we are really contributing in a way that they're happy with.
So we can have reality travel, but it needs to be done thoughtfully in ways that respect the culture, respect the people, and leaves money in the community rather than just kind of a global voyeurism. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Paige McClanahan. Her book is The New Tourist, Waking Up to the Power and Perils of Travel. Paige, when we talk about local governments that recognize the possible pros and cons of stoking or hindering tourism in their economy, It's a fascinating sort of story, and we can learn by examples. You talk about a lot of them in your book. My favorite little town in the Swiss Alps is Gimmelwald. And Gimmelwald has made a point of not being developed. They actually falsely declared their community avalanche zone so nobody could get a building permit, knowing that if they had building permits, you'd have investments and you'd have big fancy hotels and it would change the culture. Just up the hill a little ways is another town that has embraced tourism, and it's got all sorts of international mass tourism hotels and this kind of thing. It's got a thriving economy, but it's got no community. So a community has to make that choice. I was fascinated in talking with people in Alaska, and they have a hard decision. Will we welcome cruise ships, or will we say, hell no, we don't want that to own our economies? It's not an easy solution, isn't it? What are some examples that you've encountered in governments shaping their relationship with tourism?
You know, you kind of hit the nail on the head there in talking about the conversations that are happening within these communities. It's not an easy conversation. The really important point is that the conversation is happening and that the members of the of those communities are actually having a voice because, you know, in some communities, maybe they really want to go for it and others not so much. I think it's important that it's a really collaborative process. But just going along the sort of examples that you listed there, I mean, I think of the difference between Bhutan and Nepal. And I was lucky enough to visit Bhutan, you know, well before I was reporting the book, actually, and where they really limit tourism by having a really high visa fee. I think it was at the time I was visiting, I think it was about $250 a day for a tourist visa. And you're not allowed to just kind of wander around on your own. You have to go with a government-sponsored tour guide, and you have to stay in a government-approved hotel. So it's a very structured approach to tourism, really aiming for a high quality, very low quantity tourism. And then you have Nepal just over the border, which has a very, you know, similar landscape in some ways, but a very different experience of tourism there. I went on a trek in Nepal and, you know, you saw just a lot more, you know, a lot more crowds on the trails, a lot more litter, a lot more tourism infrastructure. It was a very different experience. I mean, and which one is better? I mean, it's maybe not for me to say because I don't live in Bhutan. I don't live in Nepal, but you can really see the different effects of these different approaches that the governments have taken in those two countries.
You know, you can sort of see it as in a microcosm kind of way. If you look at the story of one community, a lot of my travelers know the Cinque Terre. And when I first went there, it was a very poor part of the Italian Riviera because nobody could develop their buildings. You couldn't get a car to these places. And then I discovered it, and it's like finding a bunch of ladies at a biblical well with jugs on their heads. I mean, it was this idyllic scene that you could hardly imagine still existed. So I write it up, and I send a lot of people there, and suddenly the little communities become so affluent because of tourism that the local people move to the big cities, and they just hire Croatians to run their B&Bs, and you've got a wonderful port on the Riviera without any of that culture you really appreciated. The local people are happy. They got all the money in the world. The tourists are happy. They're having a good time there. But what happened to the real pithy bedrock of that community? I don't know. It's an ethical issue, isn't it?
The power that we hold as travel writers, as people writing about travel for a big audience, we hold an enormous amount of power. And, you know, I've written a bunch of 36-hour stories for the New York Times. That's how I kind of got my start writing for the New York Times. And, you know, communities notice when they have a 36-hour about them in the New York Times. And it's not always a positive reaction. And, you know, and this was something that I haven't written one of those stories in a long time for them. And it was something that I wrestled with because I realized at one point, okay, I was happy to write a 36-hour story about Zermatt, but I wasn't comfortable. I would never have written a 36 hours about the little French village that was my home, a French Alpine village, not that different from Zermatt in terms of size. I would never have written one about my hometown because I wouldn't have been able to look my fellow parents in the eyes at the school drop-off, you know, because they would not have liked me for that, right? And it's like, okay, so Paige, where do you get off? Like writing a 36 hour story about somebody else's hometown, but not your own.
This is what I like about your book. It causes us to read about something we love, we appreciate, we're passionate about, we believe in it, but it needs to be done thoughtfully. And the new tourist is waking up to the power and perils of travel. What is your take on tourism? And is it, can it be, should it be, a vital force for peace?
Oh, absolutely, Rick. And I mean, if we think about the crises that our species is going to face collectively in the years and decades to come, I mean, what could we have? Global thermonuclear war, runaway artificial intelligence, a pandemic even more lethal than COVID. You know, each of these crises is completely ignorant of national borders. I mean, if you think about it, never in the history of humanity has it been more important for us to be able to empathize with people who speak a different language, who pray to a different God, who eat different foods than we do, who live on the other side of a border, you know, than ours. It's so important for us to learn to interact with other cultures and to remain open to other cultures and to learn from other cultures. And tourism and travel is such a beautiful and fun and joyful way to do that if we do it in the right way.
Wow. What you just said is so important. We're going to be confronted by unimaginable challenges in the future. And as travelers, I think our hunch is that these challenges will be impervious to borders and blind to walls. And these days, there's so much discussion about walls, as if walls make us safer. And I'm convinced that walls make us less safe. And what we need are bridges. And through travel, we have bridges. And that will help us to be so much better off going forward.
And happier, too.
Paige McClanahan, thank you so much for all the work you put into and the thoughtfulness you put into your new book, The New Tourist.
Thanks so much, Rick. It was great to speak to you.
You can always find more about our guests with each week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Up next on Travel with Rick Steves, Sophie Roberts returns with what had been a mostly forgotten story of incredible colonial European plunder and folly. It's what she uncovers in her new book, A Training School for Elephants. They say an elephant never forgets. After covering conservation stories across Africa for 15 years, journalist Sophie Roberts became troubled by the clichés of a lot of storytelling on Africa. She found that the golden hues of out-of-Africa-type narratives tend to sell short the actual realities and often drowns out authentic African voices. Sophie came across a forgotten expedition from 1879 when King Leopold II of Belgium ordered that 4 elephants be taken from India to the Congo to tame the wild African elephants and train them how to work. In following the route they took to the Swahili coast, Sophie also uncovered the brutality of Leopold's colonial rule. Her own expedition introduced her to people who could illuminate what was missing from the historical record. The result is her new book, A Training School for Elephants. Sophie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rick, for having me on.
What a fascinating story, and what a fascinating bit of journalism, so we can better understand the story of Africa. And, of course, it starts with elephants. So before we get into King Leopold and all that, let's talk for a second about the mystique that travelers have for elephants. I mean, there's a lot of clichés about elephants. They hold a special place in our imagination. What is it about elephants?
Well, my first encounter with an elephant was walking with elephants in Tanzania. It must have been about 20 years ago now, and I was with a former poacher turned gamekeeper, effectively, and I found it utterly awesome in the truest sense of the word. An elephant is an overwhelming size compared to a person. An elephant can sense things with its feet from kilometers away. The way it communicates to its kind and kin is deeply ingrained in the landscape and the ground. And I find it a very spiritual experience to be among elephants.
Now, you call elephants like your muse as you dig deeper into the honest story of Africa. And the book is kind of built around this expedition that you describe in 1879, when King Leopold II of Belgium ordered that 4 Asian elephants be brought all the way to the Congo in Africa from India. Tell us that story and where that story led you.
Well, the foundations of it are sinister. King Leopold II of Belgium wanted means to extract the continent's resources. Previously, they'd used the backs of men, the enslaved. with these long caravan routes that ran out of Central Africa, where the main stocks of ivory lay, to the coasts. In this case, to the Swahili coast, which is the east coast of the African continent. Now, Leopold needed an alternative to the enslaved, not because he had any affection for fellow humanity, but because he was going in under the cover of eradicating the so-called Arab slave trade. African elephants had never been, well, they had in Hannibal's time, a long time, ancient times, been used as beasts of burden, but otherwise they'd never been used by people except exploited for their ivory, unlike the Asian elephant, which had.
So elephants were established as beasts of burdens in Asia, but not in Africa?
Correct.
Okay, so Leopold was seeing that this would help him export. And I guess the European approach to Africa was all about exports. I mean, when I was in Africa working on my Hunger and Hope special for public television, I learned that Africa's infrastructure for each country is just from the natural resources to the port, all designed to export raw materials. So I can think of this 150 years ago as just an effort by King Leopold to export raw materials to enrich Europeans. Was that the goal?
Exactly it. And it's running on the same trade lines as it always was. The train line, the modern train that runs from Dar es Salaam on the coast to Lake Tanganyika in the Great Lakes region, that is running on the same caravan line. The ivory used to be taken out. Now it's taking out the resources from that area, whether it's coltan, whether it's in Leopold's time, of course, rubber was the thing for the new automobile. But it's just a story of extraction and exploitation at a phenomenal level.
So in a lot of people recognize in Africa a term, I think it's called the curse of natural resources. If you are a country that's rich in natural resources, you'll get more attention from a guy like Leopold II.
What bothered me is my children are not taught it in schools. And that's why I wrote this book, because they didn't know about Leopold's Belgium. And I use the elephant as a relatively neutral way to bring a reader in to understand what really went on and how many people suffered.
Sophie Roberts is joining us on Travel with Rick Steves from the BBC studios in London. Her latest book follows a forgotten 19th century expedition from India to the Congo. It's called A Training School for Elephants, retracing a curious episode in the European grab for Africa. A special thanks to Sophie for sharing some of the sound with us that she gathered when she was journeying to write her book. You'll find photos and behind-the-scenes videos from her journey online at atrainingschoolforelephants.com. Sophie, we talk about Leopold II of Belgium, and so many of us travelers, we think of nice chocolates and wonderful people and beautiful beer when we're in Belgium. But this Leopold II, he was one of the most brutal colonialists. He raised the bar for evil when it came to colonial abuse from Europe in Africa. Tell us a bit about how brutal Leopold II was.
Well, I would urge any listener to this show to go and read Adam Hochschild's King Leopold's Ghost, which I think is one of the most important histories that have been written in the last 100 years, and that is the story of King Leopold. From 1885 to 1908, Leopold, who formerly held Congo as his private possession, he was commanding a swathe of Africa about 80 times the size of Belgium. He exploited it at the height of the rubber boom. He was extracting, well, over half a billion euros worth of rubber. He was responsible for millions and millions of Africans dying. And it is so violent, it is so visceral, and the level of exploitation, human amputation of hands as a punishment when the rubber quotas weren't met. It was a brutal, brutal regime. Did Leopold ever set foot on Congo soil, on African soil? No, he did not.
You mentioned in your book, and it seems like it's a driving sort of theme, is that it's easy for us to, quote, frame the continent in golden out-of-Africa hues, erasing hard colonial history. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, that bothered me because it's a really fixed and romantic narrative. And the more I've worked there, I became uncomfortable with it because on the borders of these areas that exist for tourism or have come to exist for tourism, there's another reality. And I'm interested in people before I am places. And people carry story. People carry memory. People carry oral history and memory through generations, especially in that part of the world. And I wanted to be able to tap that memory and versions of truth.
So that's interesting. Just last night I listened to the soundtrack from Out Africa because I was so inspired by that gorgeous, beautiful movie. At the same time now, I'm seeing it does kind of erase or ignore a hard colonial history. And what you're pointing out is important information, many stories, many thoughtful voices have essentially been erased if we romanticize our view of Africa. And in your book, you're trying to rectify that. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. Erased, if not never recorded. If you go back to the period of 1879, which I am dealing with historically, it's all white men from Europe, America, Henry Morton Stanley. They're all household names, these explorers. Often they don't name the Africans who helped them, the Africans who guided them. They were not even recorded. And if they were erased. And that bothered me profoundly. You never hear a woman's voice, ever. Wow. That bothered me profoundly. But of course, they're there and they want to be heard. And I'm just a journalist. I'm not appropriating these people's stories. I'm a conduit for these people's stories. And I find it very powerful when you realize how close the past actually sits to the present.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Sophie Roberts. She's a British journalist and author. Her newest book is A Training School for Elephants, where she retraces the story of four elephants from India to the Belgian Congo in colonial Africa. When you think about your travels as you researched this book, give us a couple examples of how your travels impacted your work. What was something intimate that you learned about a community or a person?
I spent a lot of time camping in remote places where you can sit around a fire and talk with no, you don't look at the clock. And it's a really beautiful thing when you have time to let people open up on their terms. I had this in an area called Ugala in the west of Tanzania, where I sat with a chief and his historians, and their history is oral. I wanted to understand the lineage of their kings, and they began to open up in a way that I would never be able to find in the libraries, never. I couldn't find it in the archives. I could only find it by giving them hours under a starlit sky, and it was really beautiful. I loved that. Mm. I liked connections that I made. There was one particularly moving experience where I was in Zanzibar, and I went to a churchyard to find the grave of a gentleman who was connected with my story from 1879. And there was an older man in the graveyard drying his clothes on the gravestones. I got talking, and it turned out this gentleman had an absolute direct link with my character from 1879, who was related to him. He sat on his knee. He was formerly enslaved. And I found that incredible how close the past could sit to the present. And it was those sorts of things. It was just giving it time, giving it time.
I'm so inspired by this idea that the European or the colonial approach to Africa treats the African people who are the victims of that as nameless characters. Can you just share the name of one person who had an impact on you and share what a person like that would want us to know about the story of Africa?
Chief Lindyati Fanula was the gentleman in Ugala who told me about the lineages of the kings that were missed in 1879. Chief Marambo, Chief Simba, Chief Nyunga Yamnawe. Then I had another wonderful lady called Edda. She was born in the 1930s. She told me an incredible story about an area called the Makunda Makali, which was called the Fiery Plain in 1879, because this absolutely vicious thicket of thorns that would pierce even the soles of the elephants passing through. And she could describe what used to be there before it was all deforested. Hmm. So, and then you go back to something like Conrad. Joseph Conrad was a huge influence on my kind of literary interests when I was a teenager. But then I reread it. And you realize that Joseph Conrad never gave, in Heart of Darkness, one of the most iconic books about Africa, he never gave an African a name.
Journalist Sophie Roberts is telling us what she discovered about European colonial history in Central and Eastern Africa and writes about in her latest book, A Training School for Elephants. Sophie also told us a few years ago about her travels in Mongolia and the Russian Far East when researching her first book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia. It was named Sunday Times Book of the Year in 2020. Sophie also hosts a podcast on the art of travel. It's called Gone to Timbuktu. Her website is sophieroberts.com. So Sophie, let's talk a little bit about this scramble for Africa. I was just at a museum in Europe and, you know, there was a section on this country's colonial rule of part of Africa, and the map that hung in schoolrooms for kids as they were growing up was so matter-of-fact. It just showed Africa, and it had lines and charts saying which countries in Europe had, of course, logical and totally legal and unquestionable claim to that part of Africa. It was just like a given that Africa was created for European colonialism. Tell us about the scramble for Africa, and you write about the impact of the Conference of Berlin in 1884.
It was a staggering thing. I mean, Leopold talked about wanting a piece of this magnificent African cake. That was his very phrase. It was literally cutting up a continent with the other European powers to get their chunk. And those chunks were cut in straight, ugly lines that still more or less remain in place today.
When you say straight, ugly lines, that is so poignant, clearly from somebody who understands the heartbreaking reality of Europeans drawing a straight line on a map, totally ignoring ethnic realities. And 100 years later, that contributes to untold suffering and conflict, I would imagine.
It does, and it also contributes to some genius from some African leadership. So Tanzania is the main place where I travel in order to get under the skin of this story. Now, Tanzania is a country with 120 different ethnic groups, 120. That's a lot. Nyerere, when he comes in with independence of Tanzania in the 60s, he makes one Tanzania from those 120 different ethnic groups, respect each other's difference, but were one Tanzania. And it was a piece of genius to try and just keep a lid on tribalism, which was the fear that this tribalism was going to blow up after the huge and damaging effects of these ugly, ignorant, strange lines drawn by the Europeans. So people like Nyerere did something very special. And Tanzanians, it's a very, very special country to travel in. It's a very welcoming country. It's compassionate towards difference. And I believe that that came out of Nyerere's vision post-colonialism. But it's not the same story as we well know from Rwanda.
I remember when I was in Ethiopia, the big thought was the current leader in Ethiopia was able to rise above his tribal loyalties and be Ethiopian. It didn't work, and Ethiopia is now embroiled in conflict. But that must be a common challenge for leaders of African nations, is to deal with a complicated ethnic kind of makeup.
Very. And the difference between Tanzania's post-colonial story and Rwanda's is the case in point. They're neighbors, but look what happened. Mm-hmm. I find that this is why I wanted to move slowly through this territory and understand all the different nuances in these different ethnic groups I was working with. You know, some are matriarchies, others are patriarchies. They have different belief systems. They have different ways of living off the land, with the land, as pastoralists, as fishermen, whatever that it might be. And you only understand that when you move slowly from territory to territory and listen, as opposed to flying from national park to national park, where you don't touch that human strand.
It must really frustrate you or make you sort of disappointed that so many people spend so much time and money to go to Africa on a safari, and they probably learn very little about this sort of fundamental underlying reality of the people of Africa.
A lot of people are scared of going to Africa, so they use middle people to access that safari. And I think that's a pity. I've never felt safer than when I've worked in Africa, you know, taking trains, taking buses, traveling local. I feel really safe there. But Africa has kind of been demonized to the point where it seemed to be dangerous. And I'm not by any, everybody's risk is a personal risk. But I personally feel so safe in that part of the world.
Sophie Roberts, thanks so much for your hard work on this and your inspiration. I'm sure many travelers will benefit from your book, A Training School for Elephants. Best wishes, Sophie.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, Rick Steves here. In 1978, I was a 23-year-old piano teacher, dreaming of trekking the fabled hippie trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu. With my buddy Gene, we booked the tickets, packed our rucksacks, and set out on the adventure of a lifetime. My new book, On the Hippie Trail, features my journal and vivid photos from that coming-of-age trip. Squeeze into rickshaws, sail the sacred Ganges, and look into the eyes of the Virgin Goddess as you stow away with me on the legendary hippie trail. My book, On the Hippie Trail, is available wherever books are sold.